93.5, 95.3, the new Connect FM.
Hi there, it's 12.05. I'm Mary Lynn with you weekdays, noon to 3.
And I'm Gary O'Brien, filling in my last day, filling in for Diane Ducey.
Well, and we're making your last day a big day, huh?
Yeah, this is going to be great.
Right there, you got remember the Greg Kinn band from back in the 80s?
I do. I played their records a lot when I was a DJ in college.
This was a very big song for them, the breakup song, and of course, Greg Kinn is a rocker, an author, a morning radio DJ, and he's also recently released a 3-disc digital anthology box set called Kinnplete, and Greg is here to connect with us. How you doing, Greg?
It's great to be here, and hey, it's great to be anywhere, actually.
Well, that's very true. Well, first of all, congratulations on your career, past and present. You have really done some amazing things.
Well, you know, I look back and you kind of lose track because you're so intent on putting one foot in front of the other that you don't stop, and then you stop eventually after years, and you look and, wow, I've come miles, you know, and it's pretty amazing that I've survived to this point, I think.
Yeah, and making music since you were age 13, when you put out a retrospective like this, this anthology Kinnplete, does it make you look back at your career and say, wow, is this what the dream was, or have you far surpassed that?
You know, that's a good question, because when we first started, of course, this was another era, and you have to realize that. It's quite different from the way things are today, because we considered ourselves artists. We were musicians. We were songwriters. We weren't necessarily trying to be rock stars, quote, unquote. However, as time went by, you had to become successful or fade away. And, you know, we had a couple of great years where we were just putting out everything that was a hit. But it wasn't something that we set out to do. It was something that developed organically over the years. Consider this, guys. We didn't have a number one record until our 7th album.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Now, that would be unheard of today.
Right, and so that was that Jeopardy or the breakup song? Which one?
No, that was the breakup song in 1981. Yeah, that was on the Rock and Roll album.
Okay.
But that was our 7th album, so think about that.
Yeah.
You know, we had some turntable hits, what they used to call turntable hits up to that point. But, you know, mainstream chart success had eluded us till our 7th album. Of course, once you win the lottery, you're good for a while.
Yeah, the great point. And you know, I have to say I'm so impressed with this box set, Kinnplete. You've got, you know, 3 CDs full of music, and you've got some really extensive liner notes. So you tell some stories that go along with the songs and everything, and we'll get into some of those. But you said that you've had to reinvent yourself many times over the years and dabble in many different art forms.
Yeah.
A lot of people don't do that. You know, even if it's just a regular, plain old career, not a rock star career, people get stuck in their ways and don't change. How were you able to do that? What advice would you offer to people?
You know, I think that's something that I picked up from my parents when I was growing up. They always stressed that you had to have a backup plan and you had to have a fallback position. You know, I was Joe Rockstar there for years. I wasn't thinking about doing anything else. It wasn't until, really, the hits dried up and the gigs became, you know, fewer and far between, and I took up writing as a kind of a stopgap measure there. And then from writing, I got into radio. So, you know, it wasn't a conscious decision. It's just something that, once again, it kind of happened organically. Most of it was survival instinct.
And you're talking about, you know, going beyond music. When the hits maybe weren't coming as frequently, 4 novels. You've got a new one coming out called Rubber Soul, which is, I think, somehow related to the Beatles. But I also want to ask, maybe you can touch on that too, but also you've written a TV pilot, so you've actually expanded quite a bit.
Yeah, you know, I had written that the TV pilot's called 45 RPM, and we're shopping it right now. We're getting some very good feedback on it. I kind of was in between, you know, I finished Rubber Soul. I was kind of in between projects. And I just had this idea about a drama about the mafia in the music business back in the 60s. And the thing just seemed to write itself. You know, once again, though, I was just having fun with it. It wasn't until afterwards my agent said, you know, this is pretty good. Let's go back and edit this and polish it up and see if we can sell it.
And can you give us any news on it or just the fact that there's some interest and we might be seeing it on TV?
As of yesterday, Fox turned us down and ABC turned us down. Both of them said, we love it, but it's a period piece. In other words, it takes place in the 60s.
Okay.
And this coming up TV season has a lot of period pieces from the 60s. There's the Playboy show.
Mm-hmm.
There's the, there's a couple of them that are coming. They're all coming out. They're all 60s. Oh, the one about the Trans Am, like the Pan Am.
Oh, yeah, Pan Am, yeah.
Yeah, so my agent said, well, you know, we were like about 3 months behind the eight ball. We'd have sold this with the first wave. So now the game becomes, if these 60s shows are successful, then they're going to want to sign more,
right.
And we're in the catbird seat. If these shows bomb, I guess our stock goes down.
Yeah, but Greg, quality usually finds its way in TV. You know, it used to be just the three networks, and then you add Fox to the mix. But now HBO, Showtime, A&E, all those networks are creating some really incredible television. And when you watch the Emmy Awards this weekend, you're going to see more cable TV shows nominated than network TV shows.
Yeah, you know, and I really noticed that. One of the guys that we had worked with, that we're hoping to develop a show with, has got a show coming out on, I think it's Showtime. It's called Hell on Wheels. It's about the building of the railroads back in the 1890s.
Wow.
And they did that show in Canada. And originally the deal, I think, was for Canadian TV. So, you know, there's a lot of ways to go with this. None of them are, by the way, fast. They're all really slow.
Right. Well, and you know, that's the way it is. It's always an adventure, correct?
Well, you know, I love the creative process. And I got to say, you guys, having done radio for all these years, and I know you know what I'm talking about, you get addicted to having ideas. You get addicted to developing your ideas. And it's the creative process, whether I'm writing a song, or whether I'm just talking on the radio or interviewing somebody, or whether I'm writing a script, it really is. It's the same animal. You've got that creative mojo going.
And speaking of creative mojo, hang on, Greg. We're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to ask Greg to explain the concept behind the hit video for the Greg Kinn Band, that song Jeopardy. And that's next on 93.5, 95.3, the new Connect FM. Why, just listen when you can connect. We're 93.5, 95.3, the new Connect FM. Hey there, I'm Mary Lynn.
And I'm Gary O'Brien.
Kind of a blast from the past this Friday. We'll call it Retro Friday, going back to the 80s. We are talking with Greg Kinn from the Greg Kinn Band about his new digital anthology box set called Kimplete. So now, Greg, your hit song Jeopardy, which we were just admiring there, you know, it was also a video hit on MTV back in the days when they actually played videos. And, you know, in the video, you're a runaway groom, you have zombies. So I'm guessing that you had a lot of creative input in that.
Well, you know, that's crazy because I've always been a kind of a horror show guy.
Mm-hmm.
I always liked cheesy B-movies, and that was kind of a takeoff on Night of the Living Dead. And, I developed the idea with Joe Day, the director of that thing. And, you know, we did that. I mean, in its day, we had a $100,000 budget. Now, in today's world, that wouldn't do anything. But back in the day, that was a lot of money.
Yeah.
And that was a big budget video. The reason that it did so well was that that was the year that MTV just exploded, 1983. They were looking for more creative programming,
mm-hmm.
and most of the videos that were out at that time were live or fake live. We were one of the very first concept videos that had a storyline and something a little more than just the song. And they just jumped on that thing like a dog on the bone because it was one of the few that they had. Of course, a couple of months later, everybody and his brother started doing concept videos. Probably the most famous one was Thriller,
mm-hmm.
which, if you look at it, was just after Jeopardy. So I got to think that we somehow influenced the way videos were made for the next few years.
Wow, and what a great video it was. And I've talked to many great artists in the past who consider it an honor when Weird Al Yankovic does a parody of one of their songs. And Weird Al had a huge hit with his parody of Jeopardy, I Lost on Jeopardy. What was your reaction when you knew that your song, you found out your song was going to be a parody by Weird Al?
Well, I was very flattered because Weird Al, first of all, if Weird Al's going to do a parody of you, it means that you're well enough known that you can be made fun of. You're famous enough so that they can make fun of you, which I was very flattered. And, you know, Weird Al, turns out he's a super nice guy, called me up one day. He said, you know, I got this idea for I Lost on Jeopardy. And because he has to get your permission. Did you know that? He's got to get your green light for that.
Well, it's my understanding he doesn't have to, but he does as a courtesy.
He does as a courtesy. And, yeah, of course, I was flattered. And I said, yeah, I'd love to be. In fact, I even volunteered to be in the video, which I made a cameo appearance in at the end as well.
I know, that was great.
It was just a pure pleasure working with Weird Al, and I was very flattered that he did it. Also, I must point out to you that all these years later, I'm still getting checks from Weird Al. I'm still getting mailbox money. God bless that man.
God bless that man. Absolutely.
Now, Greg, back in the 80s, you guys got to tour with the Rolling Stones and Journey. What was that like?
Well, I'll tell you, it was pretty heady stuff for a young guy. Imagine being 25 years old, having a hit record, being out on the road, you know, no chaperone. We were whacked out of our gourds, and boy, did we have fun. I got to tell you, those were some great years. And, you know, we did, we opened for Journey so many times, and I was just reminiscing because I do a thing on my radio show where I go, this date in Greg Kinn band history. And it was just yesterday, we had played in Pine Knob outside of Detroit, Michigan, I believe, with opening for Journey. And I remember that my roadies, who were, well, let me just put it this way, they were practical jokers. They got into this thing where they would switch the name of the city on Journey's monitors. So every time Steve Perry looked down to say, hello, Cleveland, or whatever city they were in, my guys were in there switching the cities. And they didn't catch on for a whole week. And, of course, we were in on the joke, and we thought it was a load of fun. Of course, we almost got fired from the tour.
Oh.
Steve Perry did not like that.
I guess not.
So yesterday, on the air in San Francisco and also on my blog, I publicly apologized to Steve Perry. Steve, I could have done something about it. I was too childish. I guess I was jealous of you because you were number one and we were number 300. I don't remember why I did it, but I, from the bottom of my heart, I apologize. Because I remember he'd go out and go, hello, Cleveland! And it would be Cincinnati.
Well, 30 years later is 30 years late is better than not at all. Touch on the Rolling Stones and opening for them. And I'm sure you had an association with Mick Jagger and Keith Richards. What was that like?
It was wonderful. First of all, those guys are my childhood heroes, so it was really a trip to even work with them. You know, after every gig, my mom, bless her soul, would tell me, go find Bill Graham and thank him for the gig. Okay?
Okay.
So, after, and we were opening for the Stones. We'd done a bunch of shows. Actually, I was replacing Prince. The Prince had opened for the Stones in L.A., and he stripped down to his underpants, his little thong, and danced around the stage, and it offended Mick Jagger. And Jagger said, that's it, get the little fairy off the stage and get me a rock band in there. So Bill Graham, who always called the Greg Kinn band when he was in the pitch, called us and he said, hey, could you just step right in? And I said, what, are you crazy, Bill? What time do we have to be there? I jumped on that one. So we ran up to Seattle. We were opening our first show at the Kingdom in Seattle and in front of 81,000 people. Huh. After the show, I go looking for Bill Graham just to thank him for the gig. And I see him. I said, hey, Bill, thanks for the gig. I really appreciate it, man. He goes, come with me. So he grabs me by the arm and he takes me back through layer after layer after layer of security. We're in the inner sanctum, you know, the place where no one goes. And finally, there I am in the Stones dressing room, hanging out with the Rolling Stones.
Wow.
And I'm telling you, it was pretty cool. I was trying to be cool. You don't want to be, you know, too goofy, right?
Right.
Like, for instance, you didn't want to ask for autographs. You're a fellow musician. You can't embarrass yourself. So I'm sitting there on a couch between, like, on one side, Jerry Hall, and on the other side, Mick Jagger. And everybody's smoking away. And this was back when I smoked. So I bummed a cigarette from Mick Jagger. I said, Mick, you got an extra ciggy on you? And so on their rider, it says that each guy in the band has his own carton of cigarettes at every gig. So he goes, here, man, have the whole pack. and he gives me this pack of Marlboro. So I smoked the one that I was going to smoke, and I put it in my pocket, and I'm thinking, oh, my God, I got Mick Jagger's Marlboros here in my pocket. I could sell these for $1,000 a piece. I go back to my dressing room, and when my guys, my band, found out that I was hanging out with the Stones and I didn't invite them, they took the cigarettes from me.
Oh, man.
They said, you don't deserve these. And of course, they smoked them like joints over the next 2 weeks. And I really do think they might have gotten high on them.
So the rest of the band never met the Rolling Stones?
No, and I always felt guilty about that. But what happened so quickly.
Yeah.
You know, I walked up and, hi, Bill. And he goes, here, come with me. And the next thing I know, he's dragging me through security. And I was going to say, hey, Bill, hold up for a second. Let me go get the guys. I wasn't going to do that. I was along for the adventure. So, and I, you know what? I felt guilty about that over the years. They say you have to make amends. Maybe that's another one.
Well, hey, all you can do is all you can do. You know, maybe how about the Rolling Stones not being so stuffy? Why wouldn't they come and meet the rest of the band?
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
There you go. And you know what? It was ironic because I was back there for about half an hour talking about all kinds of different things. And the friendliest one, really, was Charlie Watts.
Mm.
And he sat down, and he saw that it was a bit of an awkward situation for me, that I was a little tongue-tied. So he just sat down right next to me, and he started talking about how was the gig, and how's the sound system sounding tonight, and I love your drummer, and, you know, little things like that really broke the ice. And he was the nicest of the bunch.
Oh, my gosh, I'm loving the rock and roll stories. We got to take a quick break. We'll wrap up our conversation here with Greg King, because I know that, that, Greg, you've got a story about champagne. We want to find out just how much fun you had when you were here. And that's next. It's 1231 at Connect FM. We are 93.5, 95.3, the new Connect FM. Hi there, I'm Mary Lynn with you weekdays noon to 3.
And I'm Gary O'Brien.
We've been talking with Greg Kinn from the Greg Kinn Band. Going back to the 80s, I love this song. And they've got a new digital anthology box set called Complete out. And Greg, you know, tells the stories behind the songs in the liner notes that are included with this anthology. Pretty extensive. And Greg, one of the things that you wrote is that after you guys learned that the song Jeopardy was a hit song, the band celebrated with margaritas, right?
Oh, yeah, I remember that. We were out, you know where we were? We were at Custer's Last Stand, the Little Bighorn. And we were in a tour bus. We just pulled over because that was what we did in the old days. Oh, look, we're going to pass by, you know, Mount Rushmore, Custer's Last Stand. So, and I was a history buff, so for me it was always fun to pop in. So while we were there, we called our record company while we were in the gift shop of Custer's Last Stand buying fake Indian headdresses. And the guy said, hey, just got to tell you guys just hit number one. I could not, a whoop went up. We went to the nearest bar and we ordered pitchers of margaritas and we got tanked.
Hey, man, that's the way to go.
It was a celebration. Come on.
And I'm shocked they had margaritas at the Little Bighorn.
That's a good point. Well, we could talk to you forever, and we appreciate the time that we've had with you. Again, Kinpleat is amazing. Three discs and a DVD featuring all of your music videos.
And listen to this, Mary Lynn, not to interrupt, but what's great about this, the disc one is studio recordings, disc two is acoustic recordings, and disc three is live. So all totally separate and different and unique. It's really a cool collection.
We've had a lot of great musicians like Joe Satriani and my son Ryan in the band over the years. This is a nice retrospective. You get some early stuff, middle stuff, and later stuff. And, you know, as I said before, this, I think the fact that you can download this wherever tunes are downloaded, like iTunes or wherever, it really makes it easy to buy. Go out and buy it.
Yeah, it is pretty cool. Are you surprised at how the music industry has changed?
Oh, boy. You know, it's a completely different animal now. Frankly, I'm kind of learning all over again about how to market rock and roll. And this is kind of our first foray into repackaging some of the old stuff, remastering some of the old stuff and putting it out in digital format that people can download. It's all a different animal.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. And, well, thank you very much for the time. Thank you for the music, and thanks for the stories.
Well, thank you, and I just want to point out that I have very good memories of Champagne. I remember playing, we may have been opening for Journey, or I think we may have played we played the school. That was it.
Oh, yeah, the University of Illinois Assembly Hall.
Yes, and I remember we had a wonderful gig that night, and then we went out, we went to some bars with some student hangouts, and I met this great chick, and we had a raging affair for years after that.
Seriously?
I'm not going to say her name. But I just think we had great memories. And whenever I'd see on the itinerary, we were going to be near Champagne, it was like, all right.
Well, we kind of like that, too. Hopefully you'll be back soon, huh?
Yeah, I'd love to.
All right.
I would love it. Let's see if we can put something together.
You're on. Hey, we're on it. We'll see what we can make happen.
All right. Thanks, you guys. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thanks. You're the best, really.
Me too. Take care.
All right. Bye-bye.
93.5, 95.3. The New Connect FM.